Let's get to Mr. Ken Jones, and thank you, Andy, for sharing that. World War II veteran, again, served on the USS Colorado. Why don't you slide that microphone on down? And just kind of give us some of your memories of being on the ship.
10 minutes.
Andy took 20. It's fine. No, you take as long as you want. I'm not going to stop.
I could have gone on further.
I hope you'll permit me to stand.
Yes.
I'm a retired school teacher, and teachers can't talk to you. It's kind of amazing when you just stop and think about it. Back there in that other life I lived, who would have ever dreamed that a young boy who struggled and worked his way all the way up to seaman first class would ever be standing before a group like this to try to tell you something about my beloved ship, the USS Colorado. I never had the faintest idea that I would be doing something like this. I want to tell you a little bit about the ship itself first. It was launched in 1923-24, and it was built for a crew of approximately 1,300 men. By the time Pearl Harbor came along, the ship had undergone several rebuilding programs and had new guns and more guns installed, and the result was that we had to carry a larger crew. So when I was aboard, we carried a crew of approximately 2,100 men, give or take 100 or so from time to time. Now what that means to you is that it was very, very crowded. I mean to tell you that on the Colorado, there was absolutely no room for modesty, no privacy, none of that stuff. As a matter of fact, let me tell you about our heads. One of my more interesting stories. If you'll visualize a compartment, and it has a big long metal trough here, about 12 or 15 feet long, about 30 inches across it, and ever so often there'll be a couple boards across there for seat boards, and they were kind of hollowed out a little bit to kind of fit your posterity. And salt water is running through that trough 24/7. Comes in one end, flows down and out the other end. There are no partitions, and these seat boards are pretty close together. Right across the way, like maybe 5 or 6, 8 feet, there's another row, just exactly like this one. No partitions. And it's kind of disconcerting to sit there and try to avoid making eye contact with that guy over there. But that's the way it was. So you lose your modesty very quickly. One of the things we used to like to do for fun, you know, everything on the ship was not just bad stuff. A lot of it was fun. And we'd wait for a crew of newcomers to come aboard, you know. And we'd wait for them to go and sit down on that trough. And we'd find some paper somewhere, wad it up in a ball, and we'd get in the upstream side at the end of the trough and set that on fire. Now, the thing about that is you want to make absolutely certain you're not doing that to somebody bigger than you. Living quarters are very close. Every available bulkhead had folding bunks installed, you know, 3D, and when they're not in use, they're folded up against the bulkhead. And then all the deck space, where did that come from? All the deck space, folding cots, just plain old canvas camp folding cots. And those cots were so close together that you could hardly get your legs in between a row if you had to go to your cot over there. And whether you sat head to toe or head to head was your choice. It's not much of a choice, really. You're either breathing somebody's breath or you're... Now for myself, I was just a seaman second class. So I had to sleep in a hammock. And I mean just a plain old canvas hammock. Some of you have seen those Navy hammocks. And on the overhead, on the steel girders, they had hooks welded to those overheads. And we would sling our hammocks on those hooks. And we would stretch that hammock just as tight as we could get it, you know, to eliminate that sag. And then we'd take the ends of the sticks out of the cot and weave that in between the clues on the end. And that would kind of help the hammock from rolling up over you so much. Because in the Pacific, it's hot. And those ships were not air conditioned. And you could lay there in that hammock and you could feel the sweat running down your side. And my billet was just inside of one of these, just inside a hatch door entering a compartment. One of these kind of hatches that's waterproof. You can dog it down and it's waterproof. And you step up and then through, you know. And my hammock's just the other side of that hatch. And my hammock is over a main passageway where all the men going to and fro to relieve the watch had to pass that way. And invariably, they would step through the hatch, but they wouldn't bend low enough, and they would bump my hammock. Now, I'd already spent hours trying to go to sleep in that hot weather, you know, and by the time I'd get to sleep, somebody bumped my hammock. It was very hard to get a night's sleep, and there's been many a times I've just given up the hammock and take my blanket topside and spread it out and sleep topside of my bed. The problem with that is you're continually running into little rain squalls, you know, and it's just sort of up and down night all night. So living quarters were very close. Our chow tables and benches were the kind where the legs hold up. We'll put the benches on top of the table when they're not in use, and then all of that goes on the overhead in brackets, and then beneath those tables we had our hammocks. So it was very close living quarters. I think I want to tell you about my feelings, my impression, the very first time I laid eyes on the USS Colorado BB-45. And I want that to be sort of like a bookend. And the other end, I want to tell you about what I thought and felt in Tokyo Bay when I saw the Japanese come out to sign the terms of unconditional surrender. In between those two bookends, some events that absolutely, totally changed my life. Now, I'm just a little 17-year-old schoolboy. I enrolled on my birthday, January 44, 17 years old. Just a little boy, never been out of the state of Texas, never ridden an airplane or a train, never been anywhere, never seen anything, never done anything. But man, I was so excited. I'd been for months trying to, you know, begging mother to sign the paper so they would take me. And she wasn't going to do it, but I finally persuaded her. Now that's another story for another time. Anyway, she signed the papers. And I was sworn in, sent to Farragut, Idaho, 6 weeks boot training, which is really just enough time to learn to say yes sir and no sir and how to put on your uniform. After 6 weeks of boot training, they sent me on a draft over to Bremerton, Washington, and they unloaded us. As I remember, there were several busloads, like maybe four or five, and they drove down the pier there in Bremerton, and they offloaded us and formed us in ranks, and here's these two big old ships, two of them, USS Maryland, USS Colorado, sister ships. They're like identical twins. They're exactly alike. And they formed us in ranks and marched us down the pier and then halted us. And then they used a very scientific, efficient method of determining who's going to go on which ship. So they halted us and said, everybody from right here on over there, go aboard the Maryland. And from right here over there, go aboard the Colorado. Now, I still don't know how they managed to know who was supposed to be on each ship. We may have had to carry some paperwork. I just don't remember. But we were in undressed blues, and we were loading ammunition in stores. And as soon as we went up the gangplank, they had us dump our seagoing bag and hammock, you know, lashed up seagoing style. They said, dump it here, and then go to a certain place, and they put us to work loading ammo and supplies. and we were still in our undressed blues. When I first saw that ship, I looked up at it and I think, it's really going to happen. I'm going to get on that big old ship and we're going to go off to war together. And we're going to fire those big old guns and we're going to deal death and destruction to the enemy. And historians, we were going to leave our mark on the history of that war. And surely, we would return home as conquering heroes. Boyhood dreams. You guys have all had them at one time in your life. Maybe you still do. But boyhood dreams. Adventure. Fame, fortune, glory, all that stuff, you know. So that's what I was expecting when I went aboard. Wasn't too long after that until those boyhood dreams were shattered forever. Our first engagement after I went aboard was Saipan. We bypassed the little island of Tinian, which is just like 17 miles from Saipan. Went to Guam, engaged in that operation, and then came back to Tinian. Now you need to understand that a battleship is basically a mobile sea-going platform for heavy artillery. And the old battleships could not keep up with the new battleships and the new aircraft carriers. So they usually grouped us in fleets of ships of comparable speed and so forth. So these old battleships were used primarily as pre-landing bombardments, you know, before the troops were to land. We would show up maybe 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month ahead of time, and we'd spend our time using our big guns to knock out shore defenses. And then when it came time for the landing, we would be firing over the heads of the waves of the landing craft going in. Then after they got their beachhead established and got inland a little ways, then we remained on station and rendered fire support to the troops on the ground whenever they found a target that they needed our big guns on. So we were used pretty extensively that way and very effectively. Well, I'm saying all of that to say this. After Saipan, Guam, then Tinian, we covered the landing at Tinian. Several days before the landing, we went in as close as we could go to do what we call draw fire. We were trying to see if they would shoot anything at us. Nothing. Not even a rifle, as far as I know. Nothing. And then on the next day, we were covering a fake landing. On this side, the strategy was to have a fake landing on this side of the island. All the transport ships and everything back here behind us, and all these waves of landing craft going in waves, but just one man in each one, just a coxswain to drive the boat. And on the other side of the island, beyond the horizon, were other transport ships. And as we were covering this fake landing, they would be having the real landing on the other side. Well, the Japanese fell for it because they had some guns that we didn't know about. They were 6-inch guns, according to what we were told. And they opened up on us. And they hit us 22 times. While we're covering that landing, all on the starboard side. I was on the starboard side, top side, on a 40-millimeter quad anti-aircraft gun. 22 times direct hits, even for a battleship, is a lot of hits. Now, we were not even close to sinking, although we did take on some water because we were listening to starboard. On the other side of the island, we were told it was a bloodless landing. It was very successful. But for us, and a destroyer and maybe one or two other ships, we got shot up pretty bad. When I saw the result of all that carnage, that was the end of those boyhood dreams. I think I first began to think when I saw that, because we literally had to clean up the ship. We stayed on station and knocked out those guns, by the way, us and some other ships. But at the end of the day, we had to pull back and we had to clean up the ship. And for a 17-year-old boy to be picking up parts of his shipmates and putting them in these basket-type Navy stretchers, you know, that leaves an impression. I find out real quick, there's no glory in war. All those dreams of high adventure and excitement, fame and fortune, meant nothing. Because these guys were guys that we worked with. We slept 6 inches apart. We worked together. We played together when we went on liberty. We fought together. And sometimes we died together. And to me, that was a real heartrending experience. And I began to think, this is insane. It's so utterly ridiculous for nations to try to solve their international disagreements by seeing which side could kill the most people and destroy the most property. And to me, it seemed just like an illogical thing. What are we doing here? This is insane. But you know, it is what it is, and the world moves on. These young men were just in the prime of young manhood. And I can remember sitting around on the decks with them in the evening after evening chow was over, having the last smoke before the smoking lamp was extinguished. Sitting around in small groups, you know, and talking about home. Man, when I get home, I'm going to do thus and so. And somebody, not me, I'm going to go and do this, this, this. All those dreams. All the wonderful things they were going to do when they got back home. And then cut down, just beginning the prime of young manhood, cut down without ever having had the chance to bring to fruition all of those wonderful dreams. Time went on. The next operation was the Philippines. And in the Philippines, we were in the battle for the landing and supported the troops at Luzon, Leyte, Mindoro, Mindanao, and then in Lingayen Gulf, while we were under air attack, we were hit with one kamikaze suicide plane, and he hit right at the break of the quarterdeck on the port side. And in my cruise book, I've got a series of pictures. I'm not going to try to show them to you. I'm just trying to show you I've got a cruise book. There's a series of pictures that were taken by the photographer on the ship that was dead ahead of us in line. And this series of pictures show this plane coming in. We had already shot down the first one. There's two of them diving on us. And we shot down and splashed the first one. But the second one keeps on coming, and the picture shows that he's on fire. And it looked like he was coming in just exactly on where I was, on the starboard quarterdeck. Now the thing is that everybody on the ship would say the same thing, coming in on them. But we were making a 90-degree turn to port, which in effect swung the stern of the ship around so that what he had been facing the starboard quarterdeck, by the time he got to us, it was the port quarterdeck because of the way the ship was turning. And he hit right in a 5-inch casemate, and the pictures show that it sheared the barrel off of that gun. And since my gun crew was not firing at that very time, and since we were so close, this is just exactly the opposite side of the ship where I was. And since we were so close, Sky Control ordered us to secure our gun and go see what we could do to render aid to the men that were in that compartment. And when we got over there, we had to open one of those hatches, you know, and stand back and let the smoke and everything come out. And the smell is, I know that some of you men have experienced this, the smell is something you'll never forget because it's a combination of burning explosive, gunpowder, cloth material, paint, electrical wiring, human flesh, all of that mixed together. And even to this day, I'm 88 years old now, and even to this day, way after, you know, years after, I can be on a firing gun range and the noise doesn't bother me at all. But when I smell that powder burning, It brings it all back clear and plain. We opened that hatch, stood back, and let the smoke come out, and stepped inside. And the first thing I saw was what was left of about a 15-man crew. The force of the explosion had gone inside the casemate and had just plastered them against the overhead. Now on the overhead, you have all these electronic cables and wires running, and they're attached in brackets. And it just plastered them against the overhead, killed them all. And they were hanging, you know, strings. That leaves an impression on the 17-year-old boy. And I thought, how foolish. Of course, I understand that a nation has to be military, economically strong, in order to protect yourself. And I'm not a pacifist, but I'm just saying that we need to find ways to solve our problems peacefully rather than seeing who can kill the most people. Eventually, we went to Okinawa, participated in that engagement. We missed Iwo Jima, one of the worst battles of the war. We were in Bremerton undergoing repairs. So we missed Iwo. But we were anchored in Buckner Bay one day, in Buckner Bay in Okinawa. We were anchored there, and we were assembling this huge fleet of ships. And the plan was we were getting ready to invade the Japanese home islands. And I can remember the B-29s flying back and forth, seemed like just all day long, you know, bombing home islands and going back to Tianjin or Saipan, wherever their base was. And we were loading supplies and stores, as was a lot of other ships. All of a sudden, the troops on the beach, we'd already secured the island, the troops on the shore, they started firing their weapons. And we didn't know what the heck was going on. We thought they were under air attack. So the officer of the day ordered us to battle stations. So we all went to our battle stations. We were sitting up there on our guns looking. And we couldn't see airplanes, no boats, no ships, no periscopes. Nothing seemed to be a threat. And then we found out that the Japanese have agreed to unconditional surrender. You know, this was after the second A-bomb. They had agreed, and the troops on the beach got the word before we did, and they were celebrating, and we thought they were under attack. Well, we celebrated too, but on a ship, you don't just indiscriminately, you know, fire those weapons. We didn't do that, but we did celebrate. Not long after that, this huge fleet of ships they had assembled, we headed off toward Tokyo. And we were one of the first ships into Tokyo Bay, along with the USS Missouri. And this marks the other bookend of my story. We were in Tokyo Bay on the day the Japanese emissaries came out to meet with MacArthur and Nimitz on board the USS Missouri. I happened to be on gun watch, and I had binoculars. And I saw them come out in a little motor launch and go up the gangway. And I saw that they're mingling over there on the Missouri. I witnessed the signing of the unconditional terms of surrender. In the American history textbooks, you always got a picture of that. If you will think back to your high school days, they've got a picture of Japanese emissaries meeting with MacArthur and Nimitz on the Missouri. Well, when I was teaching high school history and we got to that point, well, actually, when we get to the point of World War II, we just set the book aside and we studied it from the viewpoint of Mr. Jones, and they liked that a lot better than reading it from the book. Anyway, we get to that picture, and I tell the kids, I was there. I witnessed that. Now, I didn't tell them I was 300 yards away. But that was a great historic event. The thing that I remember mostly about that is the feeling I had about it's finally over. It is really over. It's not fluke, it's not a fake, we're really going home. And so I knew it was just a short time later till we went home. We picked up a load of American prisoners of the Japanese. And I know you've seen pictures of them where they're just skeletons, you know, skin on bones. Awful sight. We picked a load of those up and hauled them back to Pearl Harbor, and we offloaded them at Pearl Harbor. Then they got on ships that had better living conditions than we had. Then we went on back to the States. And after that, the ship made at least two more runs back to Pearl Harbor, picking up troops and bringing them home on what is called the Magic Carpet Fleet. That was a long time ago. I certainly wouldn't want to go through it again, but I wouldn't take for the experiences I've had and what it has done for me. I grew up on the ship. You know, when you're 17 years old, you're not afraid to go off to war because you got to understand, when you're 17, you're bulletproof. And those bad things always happen to someone else. And that's the way I felt. You know, that all changed after I saw that bad stuff. I got out at the end of the war, stayed a year and 8 months, couldn't decide what to do with my life. I had nobody at home to advise me, to counsel me, to give me any kind of reasonable advice. And I had several jobs that I probably could have made them into something. But I couldn't find what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So finally, out of desperation, I went back in the Navy. And this time, they sent me to North Island Naval Air Station in San Diego. And that's when I met Dorothy. And she's going like this, tell me to quit. That's when I met Dorothy. And that was the end of that career. But without it, I would never have been able to go to college. I was a high school dropout. I was able to get my GED and then go to college at TCU in Fort Worth. Got my bachelor's degree, and I taught high school history for 30 years.
Mr. Jones, I think we all are thinking the same thing. We wish we had had a history teacher like you. Wow.
I thought about more than just history. I thought about life, too.
There you go.